The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
QAnon, dangerous conspiracy theories gone global, and a president who refuses to condemn them.
And you see messages in German and UK Facebook groups saying, I wish I was American so that I could vote Trump.
Also today, a new idea gaining traction, let the coronavirus just spread. Health experts warn, don't.
Never in the history of public health has herd immunity been used as a strategy.
And after canceling the school year, Kenya is reversing course, bringing fresh challenges for teachers.
Discipline has really gone down. We have to tell them this. They're looking at you. They don't see you as a teacher because they have stayed for so long at home.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Happy Friday and welcome to the end of the week. President Trump took a lot of questions from the audience in his televised town hall last night. He dodged many of them, including this one from moderator Savannah Guthrie of NBC.
Let me ask you about QAnon. It is this theory that Democrats are a satanic pedophile ring and that you are the savior of that. Now, can you just once and for all state that that is completely not true,
so,
and disavow QAnon in its entirety?
I know nothing about QAnon.
I just told you.
I know very little. You told me, but what you tell me doesn't necessarily make it fact. I hate to say that.
Maybe the president doesn't know a thing about QAnon. We're going to learn about it right now. Anna Sophie Harling is one of the co-authors for the special report about QAnon in Europe, published by NewsGuard. She joins us from London. Anna Sophie, most of us have heard the word QAnon. Not sure if it qualifies as an actual organization or what, but the connotation is that of a group pushing unsubstantiated and fantastical stories, conspiracy theories sometimes. How do you explain QAnon to people?
QAnon began in October 2017 with an anonymous post on the image board 4chan by a person calling themselves Q, who claimed to have insider knowledge about the White House and the fact that Trump is working to battle a global child sex trafficking ring. And the idea also claims that Trump is planning a day of reckoning known as the Storm, through which he will be taking down thousands of these pedophiles, which include, you know, popular people such as Hillary Clinton, Tom Hanks, Bill Gates, etc.
So let's be clear, if you're just joining this conversation, these are conspiracy theories that Anna Sophie is talking about with no basis in fact. Anna Sophie, I know that in your work you've seen enthusiasm for QAnon theories grow outside the U.S., but how does a Trump-centered mythology hold up in other countries? I mean, how does it translate locally?
So it's important to note that the way that QAnon has spread and received traction over the last couple of months is through social media.
Right.
Social media is, of course, global. There is no such thing as an American Facebook.
Mm.
For example, I'm based in London. QAnon believers in the UK think that Donald Trump has carefully selected Boris Johnson to carry out his orders in the UK. And this theory alleges that Boris Johnson is what is called a white hat. So he's undercover working together with Trump to further Trump's goals. And even within Facebook groups that are QAnon, it's hotly contested as to whether Boris Johnson is in fact a white hat or isn't. And in these groups, you can see people going to great lengths to try to decode Boris Johnson's every outfit, every move, every political maneuver.
I'm just curious, how much support has grown for Trump overseas, even among people who don't vote in U.S. elections via QAnon?
The important thing to note is that QAnon is a conspiracy theory that is rooted centrally in pro-Trump ideology. So it must be impossible to be a QAnon supporter without being an avid Trump supporter. And you see messages in German and UK Facebook groups saying, I wish I was American so that I could vote Trump. He is the only politician that I trust.
So you mentioned the kind of stories that are growing in the UK. Where else specifically has QAnon found more support?
The UK is definitely the leader in Europe, closely followed by Germany and the Netherlands. We also know that it's seen massive amounts of support in places like Australia and New Zealand. But in every country in which we operate, we've seen the amount of engagement online with QAnon conspiracy theories grow.
Well, many of us are worried about disinformation and the effect that it'll have on Election Day and the aftermath. So when it comes to QAnon, its memes, its supporters, what role do you see it playing between now and November 3rd?
I'll try to say this as clear as I can. Because social media platforms have come forward and vowed to deplatform hardcore QAnon groups and accounts, Q followers are going to find ways to co-opt less extreme conspiracy groups and political movements and insert their own messaging into those in a more palatable way. And I think when those types of conspiracies or false claims go viral without the association with a more extreme type of theory like QAnon, they can do quite a lot of damage. So, for example, if there are quote-unquote revelations about Biden being a pedophile or something similar to, you know, the Hillary email dump associated with Pizzagate, that's when we really start to see effects on elections. So when conspiracy theories are tied to prominent political figures, and QAnon, because it is inherently based in the idea that there is this Satan-worshipping ring of Democrats, if that then goes mainstream, it could have a real negative effect on, you know, the veracity of the information that's impacting the elections.
Anna-Sophie Harling is Europe Managing Director for NewsGuard, speaking with us about the growing popularity of QAnon in the U.S. and in parts of Europe. Again, I discussed a lot of conspiracy theories with Ms. Harling, none with any basis in fact. Anna-Sophie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's get an update on the pandemic. As the coronavirus continues to spread, more and more communities across the globe are imposing tougher restrictions. There's also an alternate proposal gaining some traction. Just let the virus spread and let a population build up herd immunity. This week, leading public health experts from around the globe pushed back. They warn that the idea is extremely dangerous. The world's Alana Gordon has more.
Earlier this month, as fall leaves began turning yellow and red, three scientists met in an old mansion in the woods in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. They recorded an interview and discussion.
So there's a lot packed into that.
I threw a lot there.
Where do you start?
At the headquarters of the libertarian think tank, the American Institute for Economic Research.
For the short term, my major concern is the pandemic and all the collateral damage.
Martin Kulldorff from Harvard Medical School was one of those scientists. His two colleagues were from Oxford in the UK and Stanford. Out of their visit came a document, a declaration, asking policymakers around the globe to take a controversial approach to the pandemic. Kulldorff and the others want to end pandemic restrictions, even crowd limits, and reopen all businesses and restaurants, regardless of rising infections. He says the current situation is putting too many lives on hold and worsening too many other problems.
Children should be able to go to school because they are at minimal risk, and young adults have very low risk, so we should let them live their lives normally.
As for people who are most at risk for getting really sick from COVID-19, like those who are older or who have chronic health conditions,
we have to do a much, much better job protecting them and helping them protect themselves.
Kulldorff says if high-risk groups can be protected, while lower-risk people get infected, recover, and in theory develop a natural immunity, the virus won't be able to spread much in the future. Many have called this strategy herd immunity. It may seem alluring months into a pandemic that has turned the world upside down. But Bill Hanich says the proposal is dangerous.
I think it's truly incredibly problematic.
Hanich is another public health researcher at Harvard. He says it's near impossible to isolate higher-risk people from everyone else.
The metaphor that I use is it's akin to a wildfire sweeping down a valley, and you decide to take all of your antiques and put them in a house and just encourage the wildfire outside in the valley so it burns quickly through, and then you can come out, and that you're just going to stand inside with a bucket of water splashing it onto any sparks that manage to get in. It's not sustainable.
Many global health leaders agree. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, director of the World Health Organization, called the herd immunity strategy straight up unethical.
Herd immunity is achieved by protecting people from a virus, not by exposing them to it.
Upwards of 90% of the world population is still susceptible to COVID-19. He says the way to protect people is with effective vaccinations, not naturally exposing them to diseases.
Never in the history of public health has herd immunity been used as a strategy for responding to an outbreak. let alone a pandemic.
But as the number of infections and deaths climb, the Great Barrington Declaration is gaining more fuel too. Kuhldorff says thousands of scientists worldwide have signed on, and it's not just scientists that are on board. Kuhldorff and his colleagues recently met with U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar.
We had a very good discussion. Secretary Azar asked a number of questions.
Azar said their proposal reinforces President Trump's own coronavirus strategy. Now a growing chorus of public health scientists is pushing back. This week, dozens from around the globe published a response in the medical journal The Lancet.
I'm a co-signer and author of what we're calling the John Snow Memorandum.
Emma Hadcroft is an epidemiologist at the University of Basel. Hadcroft says there's an important reason they named their document after Snow, a 19th century English doctor who famously identified the source of a mysterious, deadly cholera outbreak in London. He traced it to a water pump, and the realization helped transform water systems and public health worldwide.
For me, the big connection is the importance of using what we know about epidemiology and what we've learned about disease spread to make sure that we take the most appropriate actions in the current pandemic.
Hadcroft says there's too many unknowns about this virus called SARS-CoV-2 to just let it spread, like how long immunity lasts from a natural infection.
And certainly when it comes to seasonal coronaviruses that have been circulating in humans for many years, you can catch these many times in your life, and you do. It's probable that later infections might not be as severe, but we don't know this kind of information about SARS-CoV-2, so it's really risky to decide that that's our strategy when we don't even know it would work.
It's also unclear how COVID-19 impacts some young people. Already, serious complications and deaths have been documented. Early on in the pandemic, this idea of herd immunity came up in Europe. The proposal faced a major backlash in the UK, and leaders dropped it as the outbreak surged out of control. Hadcroft says months later, as this idea gains new ground again, a false dichotomy is being presented, that there have to be full lockdowns or no restrictions at all to end the pandemic.
I do think it's a kind of middle ground that shows that you don't have to lock everyone away in order to eventually get the virus under control. With more targeted restrictions, with more clarity on how this virus spreads, and with really effective test and trace teams, we can reopen society to a large degree and keep the number of cases low.
She says with these measured approaches, and hopefully an effective vaccine that provides long-term immunity, the world could finally reach that level of truly protecting everyone. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
Tomorrow is Election Day in New Zealand. Things are looking very good for Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. She holds a double-digit lead over her main challenger, Judith Collins. Ardern has become one of the most popular politicians on earth. One big reason, her successful management of the coronavirus.
I love you, Jacinda!
On the campaign trail, there's a lot of love for the incumbent, lots of cheering and selfies without masks. It's okay to do that in New Zealand. The nation has recorded fewer than 2,000 cases of COVID-19 and just 25 deaths in a nation with a population close to 5 million. New Zealand is now basically COVID-free. Yesterday, the entire country reported just 4 new cases. Several days last week had 0 cases. It's a point of pride you can hear in this exchange between Ardern and a local reporter.
It's a milestone, and as I've said, you know, I think New Zealand should mark those milestones.
You can also chalk up Ardern's popularity to her quick policy response to a terrorist attack by a white supremacist in Christchurch, a national ban on semi-automatic firearms. Youth is also a factor. Ardern became the world's youngest female head of state when she was elected 3 years ago at age 37. And she's only the second head of a modern nation ever to give birth while in office. New Zealanders have other matters to decide tomorrow as well. They're voting on 2 major ballot initiatives. Voluntary euthanasia is expected to pass, and the legalization of a market for marijuana that appears headed for defeat. Ardern said she has used cannabis, but won't say how she'll be voting. Here she is at a recent debate.
I want the public of New Zealand to decide this. And I want this not to be about politics.
Yes or no, how are you voting in the referendum?
And I'll be giving my answer after the election, after New Zealand has decided.
We should know her answer and New Zealand's decisions tomorrow. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 18 days to go. Every Friday until Election Day, we're gathering the world's reporters to talk about the November 3rd vote through our own international lens. On the docket today, immigration.
The whole world is watching.
The most important election.
Human rights.
Climate change.
Race. Immigration.
Value your freedom and democracy. This is what inspires the whole world.
There's been a lot of behind-the-scenes discussions about immigration policies, but they haven't gotten a lot of play in the presidential debates. President Trump did answer a question on immigration in last night's town hall.
We are going to take care of DACA. We're going to take care of DREAMer. It's working right now. We're negotiating different aspects of immigration and immigration law.
With me are the world's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joining us from San Francisco's Bay Area. Happy Friday, Monica.
Hey, Marco.
And our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry in London. Hey there, Orla.
Hi, Marco.
Monica, let me start with you. Immigration has not come up in a substantive way so far in the debates. After 4 years of practically daily crises around immigration, what do you make of that omission?
I mean, it's a massive contrast to 2016 in the debates and discussion that we saw then, right? At that time, immigration was Trump's signature issue at nearly every appearance, whether he was on the stump or during a debate. Now we're seeing, obviously, the pandemic, protests related to Black Lives Matter, definitely being asked about more in the debates. That makes a lot of sense. But it's also surprising because he's done so much when it comes to immigration, largely closing off the border, reducing legal migration in many ways, and just making it much more difficult for people to come to the United States. So it's something he could point to in terms of a success. At the same time, I'm not surprised that he's not bringing that up because some of the things that the Trump administration has done in terms of, for example, family separation have not been generally popular in the public. So it's perhaps one reason why we're not seeing him kind of shove that issue through during a debate.
So migration policy and debates on immigration may not be featuring in the debates here. But Orla Barry, there in London, as you look back at recent elections across the EU, how has immigration played a role there?
It varies in many ways, Marco, from country to country, as you can imagine. Actually, here in the UK, in our last general election just late last year, when Boris Johnson and his party won a landslide majority, interestingly, immigration was very much not an issue on the doorsteps or in the debates. The pressing issue at the time was the Brexit referendum and getting Brexit done. And in many ways, obviously, the Brexit debate is very much tied up with the immigration issue and the migrant issue. But it wasn't a topic that you heard discussed as much. But I should say at the moment, what we are seeing in terms of sort of a broad EU strategy, we are seeing a new refugee policy being developed in Europe. And it's currently within the hands of 27 EU member states to agree on it. But I'm interested, Monica, in the sort of changes that you're seeing in the US at the moment.
Well, in terms of the US refugee program, it's absolutely drastic. Since Trump came to office, we have seen an immediate slashing of the US refugee program. I mean, it's moved from accepting 85,000, more or less, refugees in 2016, in the last year of the Obama administration, to just this month, now we're seeing the Trump administration propose allowing 15,000 refugees into the U.S. for the fiscal year 2020. So it's a historic low. And this week I spoke with Adafi Okporo about this. He's a refugee himself. He's from Nigeria. He lives in New York City. He arrived to New York 4 years ago, and he runs a homeless shelter for refugees in Harlem. And we talked over WhatsApp, over video, and he showed me around the shelter, including what it looks like from the outside. It's an old church in Harlem.
We have a refrigerator in front. It's called Community Fridge. Inside, we put food. Like, homeless people can just walk there and pick up food.
Okporo is showing me around the outside of the church, and there's a refrigerator set up on the sidewalk, and they put food in the refrigerator for people who need it, who come to the shelter, asylum seekers, refugees. And it's just this kind of site on a street in New York City.
Right. I mean, the Frige, as it's known in some places, it's catching on in a number of U.S. cities. So Okporo now dedicates himself full time to helping people like himself. I'm guessing it's probably harder for someone like him to get to the U.S. now, and not just because of the economy and COVID. I'm thinking precisely visa restrictions.
Absolutely. And he kind of feels like he got in just, in the nick of time. He arrived in 2016. he was hoping that his mother in Nigeria would be able to reunite with him in the United States. That's been frozen. And he said, you know, he hasn't seen his mom, well, now for at least 4 years. And his case is absolutely not unique. And I'm wondering, Orla, you mentioned the new migration pact in the EU, and I'm particularly interested in how that's being received.
Yes, interesting. You know, Germany and France are very much promoting it, but actually it's caused upset on both sides in the sense of from countries that traditionally haven't wanted to take in refugees like Hungary and Poland and the Czech Republic. They have been quite vocal against the pact, to NGOs themselves who are working with refugees and asylum seekers. Essentially, under the proposals, countries can either accept asylum seekers or help in the cost of deporting them. And as Human Rights Watch said at the time, you know, asking countries who didn't want asylum seekers to now help deport them is like asking the school bully to walk a kid home. It has to be agreed by the 27 EU member states. Then it has to pass through the EU Council. You know, the EU Council, the EU Parliament, all these stages have to be gone through. And the hope is that they'll sign it by the end of next year. But to be honest, many people believe that it probably won't get through all of those stages.
And Orla, just for a sense of scale, what are the figures now like for migrants traveling to Europe, and where are they traveling from?
Yeah, at the moment, Marco, the estimate in the first 9 months of the year from January to sort of the end of August, start of September, the figure was at around 60,800. This year has also been a particularly strange year, I guess, because of the pandemic, because many countries just used the pandemic to close their borders effectively. So you saw less migrant flow for that very reason.
It's so interesting, Orla, hearing you talk about the restrictions on the border based on the pandemic, because that's what's happening on the U.S.-Mexico border, that we've seen a real wholesale shutdown of the U.S.-Mexico border in the name of protecting people in the United States from any contagion from the coronavirus. You know, it's hard not to see that as a very politicized move. There's definitely a lot of criticism about using the pandemic as an excuse to shut down the border.
Oh, listen, absolutely. I mean, the moment when the restrictions came in, the first countries to close their borders were Hungary, the Czech Republic, Poland, but there's no question that those three countries used it as a way to keep immigrants out.
Well, Monica and Orla, thank you both for a great discussion. Lots to think about with immigration and refugee policies in the remaining days before November 3rd. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, and our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry. Again, thank you and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Before we take a break, let me recommend a weekend listen. Right now in our podcast feed, a conversation on staying safe amid the pandemic. Download it now on your favorite podcast app. You're with the world. A black attorney in London had enough. One too many times walking into court with people assuming she's the one on trial.
This experience, you know, that wasn't the first time I'd been mistaken for a defendant. It happened to me many times before, but never so many times in one day.
Three times in one day. Also ahead, schools in Kenya change course and reopen. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from GBH, Boston, and PRX. U.S. drug enforcement officials in Los Angeles have arrested one of Mexico's former defense ministers. This is sending shockwaves across the Mexican government and will have consequences for the country's ongoing battle against organized crime. Here's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador speaking in a news conference this morning.
Yo siempre dije que no era solo una crisis.
President López Obrador said this drug-related arrest shows that corruption is more than just a crisis in Mexico. The World's Jorge Valencia joins me from Mexico City. I mean, the headline is pretty stunning, Jorge. A former defense minister, a general, in fact, in the Mexican army, is arrested. Who is he and why did the DEA arrest him?
Well, Marco, this is undoubtedly banner headline news here in Mexico. General Salvador Cienfuegos retired as defense minister 2 years ago. He's 72 years old. He was apparently traveling in Los Angeles on his way to Disneyland with his grandchildren. And U.S. authorities are charging him with drug trafficking and money laundering. And so as the former defense minister, General Cienfuegos, was not only tasked as the main person overseeing the country's now 14-year war against organized crime, but also the only person he reported to was directly to the president. So this is a very, very high-level charge. It raises all sorts of questions for the current president.
The ramifications of this arrest do seem pretty significant. The Mexican president is saying that corruption is a chronic decadence. What's López Obrador trying to get at, and how unusual is that kind of language?
Well, for López Obrador, what he's saying is that this is an issue that has been with the country for a very long time and that has taken deep root in government here. And for to have this general, it not only it raises all sorts of questions, because during the war against organized crime, the defense ministry and the military is the primary force that is fighting organized crime in this very bloody war. But on top of that, they're also now involved in all sorts of issues that you wouldn't even think are connected to national security. Just to give you a few examples, they are building a new airport in Mexico City. They're building a new oil refinery in the Gulf of Mexico. They're even overseeing the bank that oversees some of the social welfare programs for like retirement or like scholarships for high school students. So these charges create a host of new problems for President Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
Yeah, where does this bombshell arrest leave the president on corruption and organized crime?
This creates renewed pressure on the president to address corruption. The president had campaigned, and he has continued to say that he wants to address the issue of corruption. And despite that, he has been somewhat reluctant to go after former presidents. His last two, three predecessors, there have been accusations of them being corrupt. And so these new accusations are probably going to have push him to at least take some sort of new approach against corruption in the country.
And what about the relationship between the governments of the U.S. and Mexico? This was a DEA arrest. Does this arrest have any impact on bilateral relations?
Probably, because the DEA and U.S. Agencies regularly collaborate with their counterparts here in Mexico. And that basically means this ministry that General Cienfuegos used to oversee. And this is all entirely built on personal relationships. In fact, I spoke with a personal friend of the general who, you won't be surprised, basically is denying these charges. But he's saying that whether or not they are true, this is going to have an impact on the trust that Mexican intelligence officials have with their counterparts in the United States.
The World's Jorge Valencia in Mexico City telling us about the news of the arrest of a former Mexican defense minister by the DEA. Jorge, thanks for your time.
You're welcome, Marco.
Back in March in Kenya, schools across the country closed their doors. The expectation was that the new school year would also be canceled, but parents and teachers got a pleasant surprise. Schools have now reopened and students are back in class. In Nairobi, the world's Halima Gikandi visited one school to see how things are going.
For the past 7 months, the desks at the Global One school have been stacked on top of one another, shoved into classrooms that were starting to collect dust. Now, life is coming back to this primary school. Students in this fourth grade class, wearing matching blue uniforms, try their best to sit still.
So, the first time I made firewood. Do you
know
firewood?
Yes.
Judith Odero teaches science and math. She says it's been pretty rowdy, as if the school year was never put on pause.
Discipline has really gone down. We have to tell them this. They're looking at you. They don't see you as a teacher because they have stayed for so long at home.
Even though discipline has gone down, Odero says she's actually very happy to have her students back in class.
As a teacher, I'm so glad to come back. I missed the children. I missed doing my work. I really missed it so much. So I was so happy when they told us that the schools are resuming, because waiting until January was going to be too long.
Waiting until January to reopen schools was Kenya's original plan. Then, earlier this month, the government changed its mind, saying schools could reopen starting this week. Officials announced a long list of new health regulations, including requiring every student to wear a mask. That's not an easy task for 10-year-olds, says Judith Odero.
With the rules and regulations, it's tough. Monitoring the kids, they're not used to this. Wearing masks all the time, keeping social distance, they're not used to this. So we have to keep on checking on them each and every time. They misplaced the mask. Like, they came with the mask in the morning, like all of them, but now after we had gone for break, like two of them has misplaced their masks.
Schools have also been scrambling to meet other regulations, like fumigating their classrooms and buying temperature readers. It's understandable because they've really only had a week or two to prepare. So far, it's just three grades that are back in session, two in primary and one in secondary. The Ministry of Education sees it as a trial run. If schools manage okay, then other grades can begin to come back too. But with such short notice, Odero says not every student has managed to return.
Some of them traveled to upcountry, and because of the hardships that the parents have gone through, so we have got calls telling us that they are coming, but they are still looking for transport to come back.
Odero says 9 out of the 57 students in that grade haven't come back to class yet. Here's one student who did.
What's your name?
My name is Yuvina Amondi.
10-year-old Yuvin Amondi tells me her favorite subject is English.
And did you miss being out of school?
Yes, I really miss school very much.
Amondi says she didn't stop her schoolwork completely. Her older cousin was teaching lessons to her and some other kids at home. But she says she's happy to be back in school for real.
Have you been wearing a mask the past couple months?
Yes.
How has it been for you?
It was not bad.
Not bad, she says. And come to think of it, I've seen more children wearing masks than adults. This school is in a poor area of Nairobi called Kibera. Life here has pretty much returned to normal, says Vitalis Karani. He's a local barber. Look at people around here, he says. They're just walking around with no masks. Karani says a lot of people have lost their jobs. Even for him, business is down. So he wasn't financially prepared for the last-minute school reopening. I have 4 kids in school, he tells me. 2 have gone back to class, which is great, Karani says. But like many parents, he says he doesn't have the money for school fees. Kenya's Ministry of Education pleaded with school administrators this week not to turn away students because of unpaid tuition. Odero, the teacher, says this puts small private schools like hers at a disadvantage.
Because, you know, when they announced that the schools are reopening, the government schools were provided with some funds to cater for the children need, like food and everything. But the private school, we have to depend on our own.
She says not a single parent has paid fees so far. So the school is finding ways to cut costs. In the long term, it will all work out, says John Derito. He is a professor of education at Kenyatta University. Derito argues that the cost of keeping schools closed countrywide just wasn't worth it.
Failure to open now would have cost the government and all the stakeholders so much.
He says schools would have lost a whole academic year, and many students would have had to repeat a grade. Remote learning was not an option for everyone. Derito says students need to be in the classroom. One problem he does foresee, however, is making sure there's enough classroom space and enough teachers.
With social distancing, we will require more classrooms, we will require more spaces for the library, more spaces for the dormitory.
That's something on teachers' minds, too. For now, they've managed to keep students in smaller class sizes, but if or when other grades start to return to school, that's going to be a challenge. For health officials, the worry is that Kenya could see another wave of coronavirus outbreaks. In fact, new infections spiked this week. Medical experts are warning that if people don't stick to the rules, schools might have to shut down again. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
I thought I'd explain what happened today because I'm absolutely exhausted. So begins a tweet thread that Alexander Wilson wrote last month. Wilson is a barrister in London, an attorney. Here's the background to that thread. In England, Scotland, and Wales, just 1.2% of the police force is black, and only 1.1% of court judges are black. Now, people of color throughout the legal system are speaking out about the racism and inequalities in every corner of their profession. Alexandra Wilson joins us from London. You began that Twitter thread saying that what happened to you, and generally what happens to people of color, blacks especially, what you confront in the legal system is pretty distressing. Can you tell us what happened to you last month in the magistrate's court that led to that thread?
Absolutely. So that day I was representing a client in the magistrate's court. In the magistrate's courts in England, we don't wear wigs and gowns, which are often, you know, associated with English barristers. I'd attended court dressed as I always would, you know, black suit, carrying my laptop. And three times that day, I was mistaken for being a defendant. The court security at first asked for my full name so that they could tick my name off of the list of defendants. I explained that I wasn't there as a defendant, I was there as a barrister. And he did apologise, but then that continued. So when I went into the courtroom, another legal representative told me to leave the courtroom and wait outside to sign in for my case. Again, I explained that I was a barrister. And then when I was in the courtroom trying to speak to the prosecutor before the case, the court legal advisor shouted at me to get out of the courtroom and again, wait outside to sign in for my case, and then asked whether or not I was represented. It just really highlighted for me a huge problem that we have in the UK of over-criminalising black people, so that when black people are seen, they're assumed to be, you know, a defendant rather than a professional.
Your thread got a lot of attention. Why did you share your story, and what response did you get from other black barristers and others in the legal profession? And it wasn't just in the UK, it was all over the globe, right?
It was all over the globe. And the reason I shared my story was because that day, it really did just feel like the tip of the iceberg. It happened one too many times. Within, you know, 24 hours of me tweeting it, I'd had phone calls from all of my black colleagues, black judges, black QCs, you know, the highest level of barrister in our country. And they'd all called me to say, you know, they'd been through the same thing. And so I think it really highlighted for me that this was a real systemic issue. This wasn't, you know, a one-off experience.
So you ended up filing a formal complaint with the courts. Have you seen any change since then, or what was the reaction?
I've been reassured that training is being rolled out. You know, for a long time, we've been having unconscious bias training as part of equality and diversity training. But I actually think that sometimes unconscious bias training can be used as an excuse. You know, people think, oh, I have an unconscious bias and therefore fail to take responsibility of their biases. I actually think that the training that we need to see is anti-racist training, where people are understanding the systemic racism that's around us and committing themselves to tackling that. I don't think that the training that's currently there is good enough.
Alexandra, considering the legal system is framed around the government, I mean, it's the government's thing. How do you get the government to change all that?
I think the government need to be committed to tackling racism, and they claim they are. In my view, there's no such thing as just someone who's a non-racist. You know, you either have people who are racist or people who are committed to tackling racism, you know, what I would call an anti-racist. And so for many people who just sit there and sort of say, well, you know, I wouldn't say a racial slur, I wouldn't actively discriminate, that doesn't mean that you're not racist. You need to be committed to actively tackling it. And I think the government need to take that approach.
Right. And I gather this was not the first time incidents like this have happened to you. You've written a memoir called In Black and White, A Young Barrister's Story of Race and Class in a Broken Justice System. You address gender, racial and class inequalities in the legal system. How early on in your career in the law did you realize these issues existed?
I think from day one. I remember the first day that I went into the courtroom, and I noticed that of all of the professionals in there, and there were multiple, I was the only one that wasn't white. And that became a really common experience. You know, I'd go into courtrooms and rarely ever see someone who wasn't white, let alone black. And the only people that I did see that looked like me were the defendants. And it made it really difficult because you can see it right in front of your eyes. You're confronted with this huge disparity every single day. And, you know, I've written a book that hopefully, you know, it's being read by judges, by barristers, as well as, you know, members of the public. And hopefully that will begin to educate people on what it might be like to be a minority in a system that is still way too white, middle class and male dominated.
Well, as I pointed out earlier, the number of black court judges in the UK is extremely low, just 1.1% across England, Scotland and Wales. Just remind us, Alexandra, why it's important to have a justice system that mirrors the community it serves. And how does that low percentage of black judges impact your experience in the court as a black barrister? I mean, do you believe it plays out in verdicts?
Part of it is how the defendants are feeling when they go into a courtroom. I've had so many clients who outrightly will say to me, you know, how can I expect the system to be fair when people like me are only seen on one side of the system? I was called to the bar in 2018, and it was only about a couple of months ago that I saw a black male judge for the first time. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, going into a courtroom every day and not seeing people in the more senior positions that look like you can be quite disheartening. It is an uncomfortable thing. Being a black barrister in this country, not only do you have to deal with all the challenges that you do as a barrister generally, but you've got the additional challenges of, for example, being mistaken for being a defendant. Then again, not seeing role models that look like you. So I think it has a huge impact on both my clients and the profession.
Alexandra, what got you into the law in the first place? Why did you want to become a barrister?
I first became interested in the law when I was a late teenager. A close family friend of mine was a young black boy, and he was killed for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was assumed to be a part of a rival gang, and that cost him his life. And for me, that was something that I really struggled to understand. And so I became very interested in his case. It was devastating for me and my family. Mm. And I wanted to do something practical about it. And that led me to a career in the law where I feel like I get the academic interest, but also, you know, I feel like I'm making a practical difference on the ground.
Alexandra Wilson, it certainly sounds like it. Alexandra Wilson is a barrister specializing in criminal and family law in the UK. She's also the author of In Black and White, A Young Barrister's Story of Race and Class in a Broken Justice System. Alexandra, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Pretty much ever since the pandemic hit U.S. shores, offices in Silicon Valley remain largely empty. Many white-collar employees continue to work from home, but janitors, bus drivers, security guards, most of them are immigrants or people of color, and they still need to go to work. KQED's Sam Harnett reports on what they're facing.
There's a mantra of sorts in Silicon Valley, that each tech job creates five service jobs. That's what Enrico Moretti, an economist at the University of California, Berkeley, wrote in 2012. True or not, this argument has helped get tax breaks for companies like Twitter and Google to grow their presence in the Bay Area. But the pandemic has upended this calculus.
Ask the teacher, mommy.
Liliana Morales is trying to find a quiet spot. The bathroom is usually a good bet, but even it can be breached.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry. No.
You don't have to. Okay.
She's calling me, mommy. So what was the question? Sorry.
Morales' three kids are all at school, and that means three separate Zoom calls in their small home. It's in East Palo Alto, four blocks from the Facebook headquarters. Morales used to work as a prep chef there, earning around $22 an hour. When the pandemic hit the U.S., Morales worried she'd lose her job. Her husband had already been laid off from his maintenance job. She was supporting the whole family. But instead, her supervisor said she'd keep getting paid along with her coworkers.
I was thankful because I didn't expect that they're going to do the right thing, but I see they have been doing it.
Some Silicon Valley companies like Facebook and Alphabet, the parent company of Google, are continuing to pay contractors. Both those companies have been doing well during the pandemic, hiring thousands of new employees. Maria Noel Fernandez is with the labor group Silicon Valley Rising, which advocates for service workers at tech companies. Fernandez says contractors are only getting treated well now because workers and the labor movement brought attention to Silicon Valley's two-tier class system.
Now, had these workers not been organizing in the streets and in boardrooms over the last several years, I don't know if these tech companies would have done the same thing.
There's no official count of all the ancillary service workers for tech companies, but it's in the tens of thousands in the Bay Area. Most are people of color, and many are immigrants. And those who are undocumented cannot access benefits like unemployment insurance. They also didn't receive any pandemic relief checks from the federal government. When they're fired, they're on their own. And some big Silicon Valley companies are firing workers. A subcontractor working for Lyft laid off 63 janitors via text messages in September. Subcontractors for Tesla laid off 280 bus drivers and janitors. The same thing happened to 120 cafeteria workers at Verizon-owned Yahoo.
Sí, mi nombre es Agustina Sánchez.
Every workday for the last 12 years, Augustina Sanchez woke up early and headed to the cafeteria at Yahoo. She worked the front of the house, explaining the menu, taking special orders. She loved the job. It felt like it was her home, like family.
Lo hacía con muchísimo gusto. Como que si era mi casa, como que si era mi familia.
Then last month, she got an email.
Una semana antes del 5 de septiembre, recibimos una notificación de que fuimos, recibimos laid off.
Sanchez was laid off along with 119 of her coworkers. She says she's now getting texts from the Yahoo employees that she used to serve. They're upset and offering to try and help her out.
Y recibo mensajes que cuentan con nuestro apoyo.
Sanchez says she's already looking for a new job, but now with the pandemic, no one is hiring. Even though Sanchez is in such a precarious position, she's determined to help other service workers. She's been volunteering with her church to deliver food to people in her neighborhood who have contracted COVID-19.
Están teniendo más y más y más. Se me hace totalmente injusto.
Sanchez says this all feels like a nightmare, especially in the Bay Area, where some people earn more and more and more, while so many are struggling to survive. Yahoo did not respond to a request for comment. There is currently no official count of how many contract workers in Silicon Valley have lost their jobs in the pandemic and how many are continuing to be paid. For The World, I'm Sam Harnett in East Palo Alto, California.
Finally today, endangered birds and what they sound like. London composer Cosmo Sheldrake recently sat down with our friends at the Intelligence Podcast, which comes to us from Economist Radio. Jason Palmer is the program's host, and I just want you to hear this part of their conversation as Jason speaks with Cosmo Sheldrake about the inspiration behind his new album, Wake Up Calls.
It's a project that I've been working on for a number of years. It's slowly, organically grown together. Originally, it was my girlfriend painted me a picture of an owl and then asked me for an owl in return. And so I'd got recordings of each of the British owls and chopped them together and made a piece for her. I was also at the time very interested in making music from recordings of extinct animals. And then slowly both of those things shifted and formed this project more focused around endangered birds.
How did you go about it?
A lot of the pieces I originally started composing, mainly for people to wake up to. So it was customised alarm clock music. And then I ended up with this collection of tunes, bits here, bits there. And during lockdown, just being surrounded, I escaped from London and moved to Dorset. My studio is right next to a bird feeding table with a huge window. And I was just surrounded by birdsong. And it just felt like an appropriate time to kind of weave it all together and wrap it all up.
And how did you actually capture the sounds?
Some of them I recorded myself. So I spent many evenings crouching by a hedge, waiting for a nightjar to strike up and cycling around some of the downlands near here, finding skylarks, and then leaving mics taped in the hedgerows and sitting there with headphones with long cables, just waiting for the birds to sing. And then some of them friends lent me or I found in archives. But yeah, it's a kind of real patchwork quilt of different sources.
And is it an appreciation of or a kind of musical activism in terms of the endangered species part?
I guess a bit of both. On the one hand, it's just my response to spending this time listening to and being immersed in birdsong, but it's also an attempt to bring to our awareness this absolutely amazing sonic landscape which is rapidly disappearing.
Cosmo Sheldrake is not the first composer to be inspired by bird songs. Mozart, Handel, Vivaldi all had their ears tuned to the sky and trees. You can hear more about avian inspiration and classical music with host Jason Palmer of the Intelligence Podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. And that's going to do it for us this week from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Listen to the sky and trees this weekend, and we'll see you back here on Monday. Thank you.
PRX.